Hey, how's it going? You know, I want to say it was an honor listening to everyone speak, and yeah, I'm a little nervous. I don't know why, but Howard Zinn, of course, you're an inspirational human being, and it's just an honor to be in your presence. So anyway, I want to ask a question. It's more of a philosophical question, but I want to be optimistic about change, and I think change can happen, and obviously throughout history it has happened. But if you look at history in general, there's always, after the change has passed, there's always one constant, and that constant is the hierarchies that are always set up throughout society. There's always some kind of hierarchy where the pinnacle always sends people to war. So my question is, do you think that war and going to war is part of humanity, where it is good to be optimistic about change, but it's hard to get rid of it because it's something that always be within us? Not that I advocate for war. I see you shaking your head, but I just want to know what your opinion on that would be.
That's a very important question, because I've found that whenever you get into a discussion about war and the causes of war, 17 minutes after the beginning of the discussion, this is a scientific statement, 17 minutes after the beginning of every discussion on the war, somebody says, it's human nature. And I see no evidence for it. There's no genetic evidence for it. There's no anthropological evidence for it. There's no psychological evidence for it. What is the evidence for it? The evidence for it is that we've had wars again and again and again. Do these wars come out of human nature? I doubt it very much. One reason I doubt it is that if wars came out of human nature, governments wouldn't have to work so hard to get people to go to war. People go to war when they're fired up, when the society, the government, the powers that be cajole them, persuade them, entice them, rev them up, give them slogans. Yeah, sure, people can be revved up to go to war, but they have to be revved up. It doesn't come from within, it comes from without. It's very important, because if you think it comes from within, you will be deflected from your attention to the people who make war. And you will think, well, it's us, it's human beings. It's not us. There are war makers, and they're the people who are driven, mobilized, cajoled, coerced. All you have to do is see the history of wars. It doesn't come as a result of spontaneous rushing. No. If it's not human nature, it's something in the structure of society, in the powers that are exerted upon us to get us to go to war, and our job is to resist those powers, to resist the propaganda, to take apart the slogans of we're doing this for freedom and democracy, for this, for that, to dissect those slogans and look at war as it actually is, you know, which is inevitably the indiscriminate killing of huge numbers of people, whatever the justifications given to us. You know, the human brain, unfortunately, the human brain is capable of, as you know, amazing, amazing things. Anybody who's ever flown in a jet plane knows that. The human brain is amazing. It's also capable of rationalizing anything and finding excuses and reasons. And human nature is one of the pernicious of reasons, because it turns our attention away from really working against the powers and are working against their propaganda in order to one of these days, and it will happen, one of these days, one of these years, one of these decades, we will. I think hard as it may seem, I think we're moving towards that. I think more and more people are getting sick of war. More and more it's becoming evident that wars don't accomplish anything. You make war, you don't win. Nobody wins in war. And it's becoming more and more evident that war is futile, it's stupid, it's ugly, it's immoral, it should be avoided at all costs. And we have to find other ways. There's aggression in the world, there's tyranny in the world, there's this in the world, there's that in the world. War will not solve any of those problems. We have to find non-violent ways, yes, non-warlike ways of dealing with these problems. That's a first step for us, to think about that and to pass that on to people who believe that human nature is responsible.
Now, I think it was really valuable you asked that question. And I just want to add a little bit of historical depth to your question, that for many centuries, for instance, you would hear Scandinavians in the 16th and 17th century, people were scared of them. They were seen as the most militaristic people on the planet. Late 18th, early 19th century, people were terrified of the French. Obviously, because of the two world wars, Germans were very afraid. People were afraid of them. But look what happened. Back in the 1980s, you had neoconservative commentators like Norman Podhoretz writing, the Germans are not showing enough military fiber. They're not, you know, we thought it was this great thing. The Germans had seemed to become a little more pacifistic. But, you know, some of the people who, you know, we talk of the peace movement. Edward Thompson used to say we should talk about them leading the war movement. Some of the war movement people, they were angry. The Germans don't seem like they're willing to fight so much, and we have to change that in their culture. So that's the thing I find very striking in history, is sometimes the malleability. Now Scandinavians are seen as some of the most pacifistic people on the planet, but you could go back, you know, to another period in history and people would just say, they're warriors. They're the most terrifying people you'd ever want to meet. So, you know, I think that's something we should keep in mind about how much some people change, and sometimes in very short periods of time, in fact. So another question, come up here, sir.
It's very important as a stratagem that we consider tax resistance, in specific donating taxes maybe to the peace movement. And I was wondering if you could talk maybe about your thoughts, insights, experiences on that. Thank you. Either one of you. Or anyone who wants to talk.
Are you asking about tax resistance?
Yes, I am.
Oh. Tax resistance. Don't pay taxes. That's a, it's a hard thing to do, you know. But there's a movement in this country, a movement of tax resistors. There must be a taxresistors.org, or some, I assume there's any combination of letters in the world ending with org will bring up some result on your computer. So, I mean, tax resistance is one way, you know, that people in their own quiet way can make a declaration against war. It's one of many, many ways. And so those of you who there's no one way, you know, very often people think there's one thing. No, there's no one thing. Many, many different ways. That's one. Making documentary films is one way. Resisting taxes is another way. Talking to your neighbors is another way. You have to find the way that suits you, that you feel comfortable with, that you feel good about, and follow that way. And if it's tax resistance, good. If it's something else, but it has to be something.
I had a question. It's about something I've been thinking a lot about recently. Part of peaceful resistance, the idea of accepting your punishment and going to prison, that came up a couple times today. And I've been struggling with the idea because I have a problem with, I feel that to some extent, I've been feeling that that might admit to the authority of the government to place you in prison. And also, I just don't think that this government or any other government that I've personally dealt with has that authority over me. And if I felt that I committed a crime that I should be punished for, I might subject myself to that punishment because of my own beliefs, but I don't think it's up to our government. I don't think they've proven to me on any level that they have that moral authority. So I don't know if it's worth the possible statement of going to prison to subject myself to that. And I was wondering what you're, anyone who wants to answer.
It's just a topic dear to my heart because during Vietnam I was arrested, but I haven't been arrested during this war. And being a very good friend of Dan's, well, like all colleges, we have you know, teach-ins and panels and discussions. And I brought my 16-year-old friend, a young man named Alex, to one of these days at Fordham. And right away, he got completely radicalized. He has long hair, and they said, "You want to go to Washington and do civil disobedience?" And then all of a sudden, it was this moment of truth where his family and my family had to start talking, because all of a sudden, Alex really wanted to go to Washington and be arrested. And he was 16. And this is probably sounds really strange, but I decided to invite Dan over, and Dan came over to dinner, and we all talked about it. And because that is Dan, what Dan and Phil did, but in the book I talk about how when Dan wrote about Phil's life when he died, it was very moving, the experiences that Phil had had in jail and the troubling experiences that he had had in jail. And this is what Dan said about Phil. As Dan remembered the life of his brother, he acknowledged the high cost of frequent incarcerations. Phil, he said, learned patience through bolts and bars, through stopped clocks and time served at the icy hands of judges and guards and wardens. He learned it through the war-making state and the complicit church, through long sacrifice and small return, through 35 years of American war and scarcely a week of genuine peace. So what we came to in this long discussion with my friend Alex was that I think two things about it. When there is a critical mass where media coverage might actually affect opinion, it has its complicated explanation because we do mass demonstrations or we do demonstrations because we want to bring public awareness. How do we get the public awareness if there's absolutely no media coverage, right? And then if we subject ourselves to these brutalities, it's long occurred to me that Dan is a very, very special person, that I like to call him a holy man, and he's in the category of people, he knows very well what he's doing. And he has the psychic makeup to be able to understand it. I worry about my students and people that I know subjecting themselves to that type of brutality, because I've had many of my students long blog stories of what's happened to them, of 15 hours in a bus with their hands tied behind their backs and no food and no ability to get to the bathroom. And I think that we do brutalize ourselves. You're really right to bring it up. So I don't have the answer, but I just have the categories to think about it. And I fear that when some young people get arrested, that it may affect their lives in not a very positive way. And I don't think that any of us that are really, really committed should hurt ourselves in ways that we can't be effective for ourselves and our communities and to stop future wars. So it's a very complicated thing and very thoughtful of you.
What I'd like to do, a lot of you have hands up and I know we're getting low on time. Could several of you come up and raise your questions and issues? I think, you know, we can select among ourselves who might take your question, but we'd like to hear from several of you because many of you have your hands up, so go ahead.
Hi, I'd just like to thank Howard Zinn and Charles Derber and everyone else who spoke today. I really enjoyed the presentation. I've really been thinking about genocide lately. It's something that is on my mind consistently, and I just finished Samantha Power's book, A Problem from Hell, America and Genocide. And one of the things that I've really been thinking about is how much I hate war. I can't stand war. I think it's atrocious. I'm disturbed every time I watch the news. But I'm struck with this notion that if we left Iraq, which I've been pushing for a very long time, What would happen if something like what happened in Cambodia with the Khmer Rouge when we left in Vietnam happened there? What is our responsibility as it comes to genocide? And how does that relate to converting our military into a force that can intervene humanitarily as opposed to just being a force for aggression? So my perspective on that is, do we need better ideas about how to combat genocide? Is a military option always wrong? Is a humanitarian intervention something we shouldn't think about? So I've really been disturbed with the apathy that the American government has had vis-a-vis genocide. So I just wanted to know Howard Zinn's perspective and Charles Derber's, if you guys would.
I wanted to also say something briefly about the question of turning yourself in or letting yourself be arrested in an action. I really appreciate the question and also your response. I just wanted to share with you that I did my research for my dissertation with both nonviolent activists and autonomous activists in Germany, and they exemplify these two perspectives on that question. And the nonviolence activists followed the normal tradition of letting themselves be arrested. And the autonomous movement, even when doing nonviolent actions, and they sometimes did not so nonviolent actions, but even when doing nonviolent sabotage actions and things like that, they wouldn't allow themselves to be arrested. They would create their own media. And the reason was exactly what you said, because they didn't want to grant the government authority to arrest them or to imprison them. So I think it's a really complicated issue, and both sides have their perspectives, and it's worth thinking through. But I also wanted to ask you both. I just noticed yesterday, I think it was, I got word from Democracy Now, of course, that Amy Goodman had been awarded the Alternative Nobel Prize, and I thought it was really, my question was, how can we get more media attention for that prize, which is a prize for peace heroes? And I just thought it was rather ironic that the people who would give it more press attention would be Amy Goodman. But just to hear your perspective on that as a means of sort of recognizing peace heroes.
There's been a lot of talk about nonviolence. I would think if someone could speak about what exactly we mean by violence and nonviolence, and also how, if it's possible, if it is at all, to be nonviolent in conflicts that are already extremely violent, with prisons and, not being able to get food and water and adequate housing, or even in other places where, for example, you can't leave your home or, you're under military occupation.
Two more. Go ahead. So thank you again for all this, but after sitting through this discussion in Professor Derber's class, Peace and War, one of the things I've noticed about peacemaking is that the risks seem to be high at times and the victories small. And I mean, just the other day, I noticed that many kids on campus who are part of like the ROTC program here have the shirt that says "Pray for peace, but train for war." And it seems like although peacemakers are making progresses, it seems like they are so small. In that, I mean, hopefully as a peacemaker, in the future, how does one deal with these high risks and the fear of these high risks, and how do you deal with kind of how small these victories are?
So this is kind of like a follow-up to the previous question, but I'm just wondering, it just seems like that there are kind of two areas, and most of the conversation has been around what we can do as Americans or citizens or human beings in America, and I'm wondering what should be done internationally, and I feel like in terms of, if you talk about topics such as racism, you need blacks, whites, and everyone in between to come to the table. If you talk about sexism, you need, men and women to come to the table, where everybody's working through this. So, and when we talk about America, we need America and whatever that opposition is and also everybody else to come to the table. And so I'm wondering if we talk about creative, nonviolent ways to make change in the world, then how are we going to get people to all come to the table? Not that there aren't any people trying, but it just seems like a daunting task, and how do we make that first step, and how do we know that that is the right first step?
Okay, wow, it's getting late, so we'll be brief. It's, I appreciate people staying on. Yeah, it's hard to remember. I want to say first, I'm impressed by how thoughtful and reflective the questions have been, and it makes me think, you know, how much of a need there is for venues like this. You know, that you hear, there are people just all over this room who, and I mean, beyond the people who've just asked these questions, who are asking and reflecting. I mean, most of these people came up and said, I've been thinking for a long time about genocide, or about do I give moral authority to the state. I mean, these are wonderful, thoughtful people here. And I don't know the people who ask these questions whether you feel this or not, but I think here we're at an institute of higher education, and I'm struck by how little opportunity there is for people to ask these questions and think about them together. I think we have so many thoughtful people just in, you know, in this room. And I mean, imagine if you had a whole semester to really engage these questions in a deep way. But we have about 10 minutes. And I want to let Howard give the last thing. I'll just say a few things. On the question about recognizing alternative Nobels, you know, it's interesting that Henry Kissinger was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize after Vietnam. And, you know, it's sort of before it ended. And it shows you how corrupted the whole moral discourse about war and peace are, you know, in the world at large. And yet I think there's an idea that people stepping up to acknowledge. I mean, when people stood up to applaud Howard, I mean, imagine if people in public settings, you know, like we go to a basketball game or a football game, and we make all these ritual gestures toward, you know, kind of violence and war and the flag, which is a symbol of patriotism. And what if we had symbolic gestures at public events where people could acknowledge the feelings that you, like all of you are expressing? I think it would, you know, could we, you know, if you go to a BC basketball game or football game, is that possible? Would there be a way of recognizing that kind of feeling? I think it's, I'm just raising this as a question, because I think part of the problem is we don't have adequate venues for helping people express these ideas and then publicly embracing them in some way. The question about the relation between peace and racism, social justice more broadly, and so forth, is another exceedingly important question. I had a doctoral student in sociology who did her dissertation last year, finished it, based on a study of a very, very important peace organization, which I shouldn't identify, but many of you would be familiar with it. And it turned out to be a study of the problem of the way in which African Americans and whites thought about peace. And there was so much difference. There was such a chasm between the way African Americans in their communities thought about peace, which was inseparable from the violence they were experiencing in their own communities, the economic violence, the injustice, that they had no way of understanding the white peace activists who were focused entirely on stopping the war in Iraq and found the agendas of the people in the communities as diversionary. This is a huge problem in modern peace movements, you know, which have tended to be dominated very often by white upper middle class people. So I want to say that this is, again, as a longer conversation, but if you notice peace heroes, and let me just once again refer to Howard on this, one thing that I've always been inspired about Howard is that his activism spans civil rights. You know, he was an incredibly important figure in the civil rights movement. You know, but he's been deeply engaged in economic justice issues. And if you think of the people who over several decades have been what I think most of us would acknowledge as peace heroes. There are people who have been acting in a kind of holistic way for broad transformation in the culture. And I just want to embrace the thinking of a lot of people who ask these questions, that the idea of peace movements should not be separated from broader movements of, you know, there are many bumper stickers or, you know, even on faculty doors it says, if you want peace, work for justice, which, you know, I think that white people, when they think about these issues, and I don't mean to disparage white activists at all because they've done such important work, but to really think, you know, the world is a very diverse place, and I think in many parts of the world, you simply, there's not a word for peace that can be separated from broader ideas about justice. So I think the peace movement is part of a broader movement, and we tend to sometimes insulate it and lose the power of it. And the issue that was raised about how do you work when it's so hard to see results? You spend a lifetime. I think somebody mentioned with Berrigan that he felt at the in one part felt that, well, this didn't accomplish very much. And you know, I'm interested in listening to how Howard thinks about this. From my own perspective, first of all, if you look at the history of movements, although it's an endless process, I don't think this work ever ends. You see, you know, over time, tremendous change. I mean, it is significant that a black man is about to be elected president of the United States. This is, now this particular candidate is not everything probably that most of us would want, particularly on the subject of peace, but this is something different, that there have been women involved. I mean, we've seen dramatic changes. And I think that the sweep of history suggests that there is reason for hope. This idea that this is built into human nature, I'm glad that person raised that question, because it seems to me we're in a period of culture where everything is being subjected to the ultimate, you know, the queen of sciences these days is biology. And everything, if you want to know why a person is violent, go and do a brain study. If you want to understand why they act in a particular way in a corporation for greed, a certain part of the brain lights up, and you've got economic biologists. Almost every subject has this. This is a tragedy of discourse in the United States. Not that it's not useful to potentially look at some of the neurological foundation, but, you know, this is all about cultural programming and about social structure and power. I think most of you in the room, but, you know, there's a war going on for people's minds around this issue of biology. Medicalizing, biologizing everything. And of course, it's a way of undermining activism, because if it's wired into your brain, take a pill. Don't try to change the society. And so I think it's an extremely current and extremely dangerous subject. Finally, on the subject of genocide, which I thought was, again, an extremely thoughtful question. First of all, I think it's really important, you know, the notion of do no harm in your own country. And the United States has essentially perpetuated a succession of genocides or mass violence against innocent people. So I think the first responsibility in confronting genocide, if you're from the United States, in a country which is engaged in so many devastatingly violent and mass violence, is to get your own country to stop. Because that, if we could do that, we would make probably the greatest, you know, effect on stopping violence everywhere in the world. The United States, as the great power and the great instrument of violence in the world, is modeling a form of behavior and programming a form of behavior and rewarding, by direct and indirect means, all kinds of genocide. Genocides all over the world are taking place under the spirit of American, with American weapons, which govern most wars in the world, and so forth. I think there is a more complex question when it comes to, say, Darfur right now. And, you know, what does an American do about Darfur? Particularly when our own government has weakened the United Nations in such a way that it's made it almost impotent as an actor But I think that my general precept is that violence breeds violence. And when you try, I mean, you know, most of the violence done by the United States in the world today and by the Roman Empire and by the British Empire was violence done in the name of God and freedom and moral values and humanitarian concerns. So I always viscerally respond to the idea that if somebody tells you their government is going to war for democracy, freedom, God, that you better step back and look two or three times at that. When Sarah Palin said, you know, most of you have seen that tape where she said in her church that, you know, we are praying for our troops in Iraq because they are, I don't remember the exact, but it is a task of God. And this goes back to Constantine and the language of the Roman Empire when you know, this is the Catholic Church embracing state power and putting state power and war under the rubric of God, which has been the discourse of hegemonic countries ever since. So I think there are ways to intervene in Darfur that are not violent, and that would be ways of, well, I think there could be sanctions put on the Darfur government that are more powerful, that could be done globally, that could do it. Sometimes very small amounts of violence. I mean, you know, in Rwanda, the UN general there said later that simply air flights over by the UN very early on, or the very small amount, he had a few thousand troops in Darfur at the time the war broke out, and they pulled them out or made them basically, but he could have stopped it with the most minimal display of force. So my instinct is always to say that if you use violence, state violence, you're almost certain to breed more violence. But I agree that there are, you know, when you say what, and I think about what's going on in Darfur, I think that, as like in most complicated questions, that is not an absolute rule. And I think there are times when one would want to reconsider that principle. So I'm not ruling it out entirely. I'm just saying that my own reading of these situations, and particularly since almost all state violence in the world is justified under the highest moral and religious principles. It's just the name of state power. You never see state violence. Give me an example. You know, Hitler, I read Mein Kampf for one of the most recent books I read. Mein Kampf is one of the most spiritual and elevated moral statements. He was passionate about German moral values and about saving civilization and the soul of it. You know, Hitler was the greatest moralist of the 20th century. And look what he did under that you know, that lofty rhetoric. So whenever somebody says, you know, I'm going to commit use state violence to stop violence, I would be exceedingly cautious, or for any presumed moral or spiritual purpose. I would be extremely, because I think there's something about the inherent nature of state violence which is in conflict with those exact ideals. But I'd like to hear Howard on this as well.
Sorry. I want Howard to be last, but I wanted to just say a couple of more things, and so I didn't want to. I will only take a minute, though. I just want to address a couple of questions and tie a couple of things in. I think that the Project Censored, have anybody ever heard of Project Censored, the most top 25 stories every year that are censored in the mainstream media? It just came out, and Peter Phillips spoke at Fordham last night. The top story for the censored story is that about 1 million people have died in Iraq. So the media has completely ignored that. The same types of research that document the 250,000 in Darfur, now probably more, were done in Iraq, and that's how they got the number. When we say we can't leave because we're worried that Iraqis will be killed, just think about the illogic of that sentence, that idea, in terms of if people who started the war are saying that. It's often used in war. We can't pull out. There'll be a bloodbath. All of us who have been around war for a long time have heard that there'll be a bloodbath. There already has been a bloodbath. John Edwards came out with a really good idea, and he said we would just put some troops on the out on the borders of Lebanon and Syria, and then we would, if there was a blood death, we'd pull them back in. Many people understand that while there is sectarian violence between Shias and Sunnis, that it's that the United States is making it worse, not making it any better, and then pulling out. Lastly about that, it's an idea that the Iraqis won't be able to govern themselves. It's easy for us to say the Iraqis can't govern themselves. The Iraqis can govern themselves. That's also a very racist precept to say that the Iraqis. So while, and those are just some details that confirm the absolute idea, if we're a warring state, we just don't have the moral authority. We don't have a way of thinking that we can go in and help somebody else with bombs. It was so effective to see the actor actually playing Dan's words. And how many have ever seen the play actually performed? It's very powerful, and you get some good actors. And students can do it really well. You should consider doing it here. It's really fantastic. But what he was saying there was, I've seen the bodies, right? But we never see the bodies, and that's how we go into wars. But we have this strange discourse, and so I just want to say a minute about the media, because I don't think we should feel really disheartened or unhopeful. I think we're at a really important moment of hope and change right now. And it's no small feat after these 8 years of being under a barrage of propaganda that they... general public has totally rejected it. I think that that's a really hopeful thing. And that I think we really need to be able to talk about it and call these people on it, though. And when Sarah Palin keeps saying the surge was successful, what the surge means is that we lost 1,000 more U.S. troops, and we increased the bombing 500 times. More civilians were killed during the surge. That's how it works. And... the media coverage says we have really targeted smart bombs, and we celebrate them, and we have video games about them. But if we bomb anybody in urban neighborhoods, they're not targeted. They're very dumb bombs. They kill civilians all the time. So whenever anybody tells you bombing is a good idea, bombing is never a good idea. Dan and Howard found it when they went to Vietnam. There, you cannot bring democracy or do anything that of humanitarian value when you bomb. And even in with the Bosnians and Serbs, we killed a lot of civilians. The Clinton administration killed a lot of civilians. We need to get to the bottom of our culture, which is now a foundation of militarism, and the idea of that it's human nature. No, it's a militarized culture. And we need to pull back from the militarized culture, from the war heroes and the movies and the video games. And we need to be very afraid when McCain says something in his debate like, I take all of the money and just stop spending any of the money and just give it all to the military. That's $700 billion he's asking for the military right now. It's just as much as the bailout. So we have got to, and if somebody doesn't want to pay their taxes, I think it's a fine idea, because that, I think, is what's propelling this. It's the military-industrial complex. And now for Howard's last one.
These are wonderful questions, really. Charlie was absolutely right. These are very thoughtful, interesting, important questions that you raised. And Charles Durberg gave you such important and good and sensible answers. And Robin said such cogent and interesting things that I'm not going to say anything more. Really, you know. Don't you have anything to do? I mean, why are you sitting here? You must have something better to do. All right, I'll say one or two things. Okay, I'll say it as quickly as I can. Yeah, and refers to the genocide issue. Anytime a government wants to justify violence, it says that it's doing it to stop a greater violence. Be very, very careful. That's where history comes in handy. Government is going to kill several million people in Vietnam in order to, what, stop communism from taking over the world, right? You're going to do an ugly thing because in the future it will be worse. What you're doing is approving something that's obviously ugly and wrong in the present on a supposition that it is stopping something uglier in the future. But the fact is that the ugliness of the present is certain. The ugliness of the future is not certain, especially if you're told what that future is going to be by the same people who have gotten you into a mess. Don't believe the government. Government, why did we kill several hundred thousand people in Hiroshima? Several hundred thousand people in Hiroshima. Children, right? Women, old people, also. Several hundred, why? Well, because otherwise, a million people would die in an invasion of Japan. How do you know? The fact is, when you investigate it, and believe me, I have done a lot of research on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and all of that. Believe me, no million men. There was no invasion of Japan that was necessary. It was all, look into it, investigate it, read the literature on it. You scare people into committing ugly acts. You scare them by saying something worse will happen. Same thing with Iraq today, you see. What will happen? We don't know what will happen in Iraq when our troops leave. That you can't say, oh, there will be genocide. No, you can't. And besides, when the government tells you this, be very, very suspicious. Because the government has been responsible for 5 years of violence and death in Iraq. And now they're telling you we must have more years of violence and death in Iraq to stop something that may or may not happen. And it's always a choice between doing something horrible and immoral in the present, yeah, against, which is a certainty, against the possibility that something worse may happen in the future. And I suggest that, and this is where Charlie Derby's point is, do no harm. No. Do no harm in the present on the supposition that you're stopping some future harm. Now, there may be situations in Charlie Dover, maybe situations, but it won't be the government that should guide you to these situations, because the government, the authorities, cannot be trusted. There may be situations with some act, some small act. It could have been done, you know, in Rwanda. The government did not want to do it. Our government did not want to do it. There may be some instances like that, but don't believe that governments are not capable of acting for humanitarian purposes. Put it that way. When you talk about humanitarian violence, governments are incapable of humanitarian violence and humanitarian wars. So we are on our own to figure out ways, and there are ways of resisting. Those ways involve people involved. Governments cannot do the things they want to do, and they cannot make war, and corporations cannot ruin the economy once people decide that they are not going to cooperate. When soldiers refuse to fight, governments cannot carry on a war. In Vietnam, huge numbers of soldiers refused to fight. That was one of the key things that caused the government of the United States to begin to think, hey, we better get out of this. When soldiers refuse, the government is helpless. When consumers refuse to buy the stuff, corporations are helpless. When workers go out on strike, the most powerful corporations are helpless. People have the power to overcome those entities that seem to have absolute power. I will stop right there.